This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Hello, you're listening to another sensational episode of the Movie Squad podcast, hosted by me, Tristan Fidler.
And me, Simon Murato.
And we are back. We are back in session with another topic that has brought in many suggestions from you, dear listeners, on the Facebook page. Movie Squad RTRFM is where you can find updates for, you know, our weekly episodes and our podcast episodes as well. But here we are with a very special episode and a very special topic.
It is a very special topic. And like you said, we had so many responses from listeners and fans. I think we struck a nerve, which is basically what the movies we're talking about are designed to do. And the subject we're talking about is movies that made you cry or make you cry, no matter how many times you've seen it. And Tristan, this is when we were sort of devising the podcast. This was an idea that had floated around for a while. Yeah. And I think we had to work up the courage to, you know, be vulnerable with the listeners and really dig into what I think will be some fairly... Look, there's no shame in crying, but I genuinely think the choices that I've certainly got on board are embarrassing unto themselves.
Well, you know, look, there's no shame in crying, and everyone, you know, should cry at the movies, whether the movie be good or bad, maybe because it is bad. But no, I mean, movies create so many kind of emotions and effects, and when it's a physical effect, whether it be laughing or feeling kind of tense and scared, and then, you know, crying, and particularly ones that I think always kind of, when you see them again, even though you know what's going to happen, even though you know the film is working to kind of manipulate you and cause this effect, you know, you can't help but fall into it. And it's like listening to a sad song. You kind of sometimes want to cry.
Sometimes, yeah, you'll put on, you're like, you know what? I need a bit of catharsis.
Yes.
I need to like draw a line in the sand for where I am in my life. I'll put on a particular movie. I don't want to give away any choices yet. But we do have an extremely, maybe the most special guest we've ever had on the show, Tristan.
Yeah.
I mean, no offense to everyone who's come before. You're all great. But we've got an incredible third panelist here today to be vulnerable with us.
Yes, it is none other than illustrious breakfast host Taylor Strano.
Hello, how are you going?
Good, how are you?
Good, I don't know if that introduction was like warranted, but thank you.
It is warranted because you're, of course, the host of Breakfast on RTRFM. You are the one who is usually running the desk, running the master of ceremonies for our Movie Squad segment. And now you've submitted to our line of questioning.
It's great, I've got my weekend clothes on and I'm sort of like on the other side of the desk. I don't have any buttons to push. It's nice to be here, thank you for having me.
Weekend clothes, I mean, we won't get into the details, but you're dressed quite nicely.
Yeah.
Tristan and I think, are we both in track pants?
Well, I'm going to get to that point, I think, with your help breaking down the doors of track pants in public. But no, I have a sweater on that needs a good lint rolling, that's for sure. we are usually meeting every week on Friday mornings for the Movie Squad segment on Breakfast with Taylor. But now it's a chance to kind of, go a bit longer. A bit further, and you're always someone who, if you haven't seen the movie at the time of talking about, you do often see movies and maybe a week or two later talk about what you thought of the ones that we've reviewed. With regards to movies generally, are there particular types of films that you're a fan of, or what would be some of the kind of actors or genres that you always respond to?
We've covered this before on Breakfast, but I am a huge fan of really easy watch or like superhero films, which I think people find that a bit surprising sometimes. But anything like Avengers or X-Men, like I'm really into that. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because my brother and I, like as children, read comics and played with the action figures, but that's a really big thing for me. The other thing is musicals. I'm a big fan of musicals,
wow,
which
yeah.
I didn't know that about myself till I had to kind of admit it to myself when I was researching for this.
Oh, wow.
No musicals make it into my list.
Oh, no.
But,
but during the process, a breakthrough happened.
Yeah, yeah. It feels good to be here and to, I don't know, admit that on air,
I want to touch on this because RTRFM is a sound alternative, of
sure.
course.
Oh, God, there's nothing
and,
alternative
yeah,
about this.
And musicals, and look, I'm a big fan as well, and my wife mocks me endlessly. I mean, we have a very nice relationship, but she does mock me endlessly for my love of Cats, which is an objectively bad musical that I can't stop singing all the time.
Sure.
Do you like the kind of really, you know, big band cheesy musicals, or do you like the ones that are a bit, you know, a bit more melancholy, that maybe they've got a bit of an edge to them?
Nah, Go Big or Go Home.
Yeah.
My favourite film, and the very first thing that I ever bought on vinyl was the soundtrack to Singin' in the Rain.
Oh!
Like, that is at my peak.
Yeah.
Yeah, so look, that's my vibe.
Look, that's probably the best musical. So I think that's a fine addition.
David Stratton would be so happy. You know, this is it's a classic musical and one with great songs. And I remember when David and Margaret were reviewing a Boogie Nights, and they compared it to Singing in the Rain because it's also about kind of the behind the scenes work of making something and the technological change. Between them being in silent movies and having to be in sound. And also just, you know, Gene Kelly, what a sensational
totally.
Singer
Reynolds,
and dancer.
Love
ah,
it.
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah. There you go. Marvels and musicals and, or Marvels, I mean, superhero movies, but now we're just calling them Marvels.
Marvels of the modern age.
Maybe, hopefully, as the fourth phase rolls out, maybe they can do a little bit more, some interesting subgenres. So let's have a superhero musical. Let's do it.
I'll direct it. Sure.
Yeah. No, but the topic that we're talking about is movies that make us cry or, ones that always just kind of we either come back to or that can always still produce tears in us. Now, we've all brought in some of our favourites. Now, we'll start with you, Taylor. What is one film that
right.
for you is top of the list in that topic?
Yeah, so I've brought three. They're in no particular order, but one that I will start with is Paulie.
I just would like someone to talk to.
Join the club.
What?
I said join the club.
He's intelligent.
He can talk.
Speak.
Now, don't you think if we had an animal with that kind of intelligence, somebody here would have noticed?
You can talk.
Of course I can talk.
Then why are you not?
Because talking just gets you in trouble.
Why you say that?
It's a long story.
Paulie,
1998 film directed by John Roberts. It's about a bird. Are you familiar with this?
I don't know what this movie is. Paulie, the bird movie from 98?
Yeah, 98.
IMDb out. Let's get this going.
I have not seen this film, but I was trying to rack my brain going, yeah, there was a bird movie, right?
Yeah.
But is it a live action movie, right?
It is. Yeah, yeah, it is. It's the bird Paulie in question is voiced by Jay Moore. It also stars Gina Rowlands and Halle Eisenberg, who plays a young version of one of the protagonists. So basically this film is about Paulie, he's a bird, and he is best friends with this small child. She has a speech impediment and Paulie helps her overcome that because he can speak. He speaks English, but only to her, nobody else. cut a long story short, the dad doesn't like that the bird and the daughter are friends. He sends the bird away. And through these sort of weird tales, this bird is like with his grandma, who's an artist, and trying to find his way back to what he thinks is the young girl, but it's like 20 years in the future.
Oh.
So 20 years has passed and they eventually get back together and it's just maybe not what he thought. And all of this sort of chaos ensues. He's chucked in a pet testing facility and it's very, it doesn't sound sad, but it's very funny, it's very comedic, but it is really sad because all these sort of things happen. Initially I cried because this girl and her bird were separated and then he hooks up with this crazy sort of arty grandma who's driving across the country to get him to the what was his young friend, and she dies, and that's really sad.
The girl dies?
No, the grandma, the arty grandma in the RV, she dies. am I doing this correct?
No, yeah, of course, absolutely. I think we're just more surprised by the movie. Yeah,
we're learning about Paulie as it's unfolding.
And as he's chucked in the sort of testing facility, he hooks up with Misha, who is the Russian immigrant janitor, played by Tony Shalhoub. I think it's and he's sort of recounting this entire tale to him, which is where the film sort of starts, and you know, all of these sort of chaotic, funny things happen, but eventually they're connected, and that's also sort of a sad moment because it's like a happy cry.
So okay, I got a couple of questions to kick off with. So was this a film you grew up with? Is it a film?
This is like VCR.
VCR days, yeah. Got it. And what was the kind of key moment where you like locked in and was like, the tears are coming and I'm cool with that? Was it when the grandma died?
It's
grandma. Is it a reunion? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's definitely grandma. I mean, there were other points of crying. The first sort of like, oh, Paulie and his friend have been separated. That was quite sad. A couple of tears, not really. It was grandma that the floodgates sort of opened for.
Did you have a pet bird or any kind of animal like that?
I think I dabbled in pet birds. I don't think they lasted very long.
Oh, that is a horrifying tease.
But I have other. Maybe that's why I cried, because I never had that connection with like my speaking pet bird.
Yeah.
I have other pets and they're great, but I don't know, they don't talk.
I do have one more thing to clarify, Tristan, if you don't
mind.
Sure,
of course. The floor is yours.
So thank you. So the bird talks.
Yeah.
Is it like a cockatoo, or what's the bird that can repeat certain words, or does it speak the way like Detective Pikachu speaks?
It's a crow, not a crow, a crew. It's a cune.
Okay, so it's
something
not
like that.
It's not talking in the sense that it just repeats five phrases.
No, it's conversational.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jay Moore from Jerry Maguire, and I'm sure he's putting on the
he's at his peak.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, was this pre or post Picture Perfect? Yeah.
I think we'll probably be around the same time if we're talking 98. Mm-hmm. I think I vaguely remember the advertising for it, but I've never seen this film. And it is quite amazing. It sounds like, you know, in the tradition of kind of live action animal films for the family, such as Beethoven or Homeward Bound, but with a bird. And it's interesting how this kind of reoccurs as a staple, and we'll get into it with some of people's suggestions. But films aimed at family or kids predominantly, they do often hit on these very big emotional moments and can almost be traumatic in the way that they touch on things like mortality and separation and reunion.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
I think that's a good thing. I know that may be controversial, and I'm not a parent. But I do think that, you know, that there was like a study done semi-recently. I can't, you know, I'm not going to pull up any facts, but they said that there is like a level of scariness in films or in books in particular that are actually good for like 6 to 10 year olds, because it kind of teaches you, pardon me, I'm getting emotional already. It kind of teaches you that there are scary things in the world. There is a bit of peril. You need to be maybe on your toes a little bit, and that there are also sad things that happen in life, and there is grief. And isn't that also the theory behind getting pets in general, is that it teaches you that some things expire, and if you can do it in a movie and maybe give the parents a bit of an indication, there should almost be like on the classification, like, you know, not as a spoiler, but, you know, rated PG for pet death scene. So you know, if you're going to see Marley and Me, that maybe if you've got an old dog, that the kids are at least prepared for what's going to come.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, a bit of heads up is always appreciated. I think there's like actual websites dedicated to finding out whether the dog or the animal dies in a film. But Paulie, I mean, so have you ever rewatched it or? But you can
not
always
since,
just remember the effect it had on you.
I think the last time I watched Paulie, I would have been, oh gosh, like no older than 11. But I have a lot of young sort of family members, and maybe it's time to, I don't know, crack out the VCR again and show them.
I wonder if it actually even made it to DVD or any streaming service. We may have to do some investigating.
There's gonna be no way that's made it to streaming.
No record of Paulie.
Probably right. Free on YouTube now. But that's a great first one to start off with, because it's a movie that I've not seen or heard or really heard of. So it's amazing that, you know, the movies that can have such a tremendous effect. But, Simon, what would you put out in terms of something that has always made you cry?
Well, kind of crazy. And actually, there's one kind of fallacy I also want to address about this topic, if that's okay. Movies that make you cry. If a movie makes you cry, it doesn't automatically mean that the movie is good. There are plenty of films that are particularly manipulative, and they might be bad because they're working so hard to make you cry. And I think of a movie like My Sister's Keeper, which didn't make me cry, but I remember sitting in the cinema for that, the whole audience bawling very organically because it's about sickness in a young person. But that was a very manipulative film, I thought. The flip side is that sometimes not very good movies can make you cry, but that might be what gets them over the line. And that is why the first film that came to my mind was The Guilt Trip.
Wow, okay, The Guilt Trip, yeah.
We're trying to look a little bit outside the box here with movies. This is, I don't know if either of you have actually seen it, but it's the film where Barbara Streisand plays Seth Rogen's mum, and they go on a road trip together. Are you familiar with it?
I am, yes.
Yes, okay. Tristan, did you ever see it?
I have seen it, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, look, maybe skip forward 90 seconds if you don't want The Guilt Trip spoiled for you, because I just want to get into the heart of the moment. For those who haven't seen it, Seth Rogen plays Adam, and he's like an inventor. He's got some product that he needs to shill, and he's got to drive across country to do it. But his widower mother, played by, or his widow, I should say, mother, played by Barbara Streisand, her name is Joyce. She kind of guilts him into joining him on the trip because she's all by herself. And on the trip, they discover that his father, Seth Rogen's father, wasn't actually the love of her life. There was another guy called Adam, and that is his namesake. And the film kind of hinges on her working up the courage to maybe find this guy on their road trip and say, you know, I loved you. Do you still think about me? Right? Yeah. Was I as important to you as you were to me? And the end of the movie, they find him. He's on the path of the road trip, thankfully. They go to the house, and Adam Scott opens the door. And we find out that actually Adam, the guy who Barbara Streisand's character Joyce was in love with, has passed away. But he married, he lived a long, full life and was happy. And they're about to leave, you know, somewhat disappointed. But then the actress Ari Grainer rocks up. She is playing Adam Scott's sister, the daughter of Adam. And she introduces herself and says, "Hi, I'm Joyce." And you realize that she was named after Barbara Streisand's character. And that was the point where I was on a trip to Melbourne, I think, where I just started sobbing into my lap on a plane by myself.
Nice to meet you.
You too. Thank you.
I don't know if my son mentioned this, but I dated your father for a while before he met your mother.
Really?
Yeah. And I just wondered, did he ever talk about that part of his life?
No, it's okay. I'm sorry, I didn't know. My dad never talked about anybody but my mom. I mean, at least not to us.
Right, of course not. He was a very, very nice man. Very, very nice to me. And I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm here. I have enough mail here to choke a horse. Hi, oh. Sorry, hi. I didn't realize you had company.
Hi.
No, that's okay. These are old friends of Dad's. This is my sister.
Hi, I'm Andy.
Hi, Joyce. Nice to meet you. Yes. Hi.
And I do recognize that when you're on a plane, there are a lot of different conflicting emotions going on. There's a lot of oxygen being pumped into your head. But I just thought that was such a nice, subtle, underplayed moment in a movie that I did not expect to be crying at. It kind of got me as a surprise from left field. But did either of you cry at the end of The Guilt Trip?
I don't think I remember crying, but I remember that moment of sort of revelation and going, aww. Nice. How sweet. But that was probably as far as it went for me.
Tristan?
Well, I mean, I don't think I was, you know, responded to that level, but there are films like that do have that impact sometimes. And yeah, I mean, because that one was an interesting one because Seth Rogen, you know, sort of adapting his sort of persona and at that point, you know, sort of Judd Apatow produced kind of a stoner stick comedy to a kind of more, you know, to one that the idea was you could take your mum to see it. You know, like there was also for fans of Barbara Streisand. So the humour is all pretty much PG and the gags are pretty light on their feet. And, you know, there are those kind of moments of sentimentality in films like that. I can see that having an impact because I always remember, I think it was Roger Ebert who said once that he was more moved. he was not so moved by when sad things happen, but moved when, like, goodness is shown.
Yeah.
And I think that is kind of one that, that often happens when something is kind of, like, sentimental and it's and it shows a kind of a measure of goodness or kind of, like, remembering someone or being kind of, yeah, just really nice. It, you know, it can have that impact, and especially on a plane. I remember, I mean, maybe objectively a better film, but I remember being on a plane and watching The Apartment and being really...
Maybe The Apartment's better than The Guilt Trip.
Well, we'll put it out to the listeners. But, like, I remember being very much, crying more than I thought I would watching the film, you know, which is a great film, but I think also just being on a plane and going from one city to another, that the level of oxygen and the flight, you know. Anyway, but The Guilt Trip, yeah, and... like, have you ever rewatched it? Have you ever seen it?
I have not. I keep telling my wife, like, let's watch The Guilt Trip. Like, it's an hour and a half, and it's a punchline movie, effectively, because nothing's really good until that point. And it's all built up for that one moment where you go, oh, that's so nice, right? Yeah. But no, I haven't dared to stray back into that territory. Almost because I almost like the excuse of the plane and that particular experience. Yeah. If I was to watch it again, maybe I wouldn't feel anything at all, and that would be heartbreaking, or I would just... again, start sobbing, and then I have to really look at myself in the mirror if I'm on the ground and not, you know, several thousand feet in the air.
Because sometimes, you know, I'm someone who loves to rewatch movies, and I get a lot of pleasure out of that. But, you know, often sometimes the experience can be so unique and, like, particular that you don't want to. It's not like you want to recreate it or kind of. I remember the first time I saw Synecdoche, New York. I can never pronounce it right.
Synecdoche, New York.
Synecdoche, New York. That was, like, one of the movies where I came out just, like, questioning my life. That was, like, it was just, like, such a deep impact. And I was, like, I rewatched it again and, you know, I got a lot out of it, but it was, like, it was not up to that level of, like, existential, like, just wondering afterwards. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, the experience can just be individual and not, like, a, you know, one that's always going to be the same every time you watch it.
Well, on that note, what is the film that maybe first came to your mind or the one you want to talk about now that made you cry?
Well, I think a bit of, off-air discussion has shown that it might be in line with someone else's pick, but the first one that came to mind was for me Dead Poets Society. And I think you also selected that as well, Taylor?
Yeah, it's the next one on my list for sure.
Well, we could talk about this together right. And kind of hopefully, you know, you know, it's kind of like a grief support group or something.
Group therapy, sure.
But, you know, that is a film that I grew up watching. So it's got that element. I think a few of the ones that I was thinking about do have that, like, they hit you when you're young and they really kind of touch on those vulnerabilities. And for me being, you know, yeah, a young kind of boy, and that film being about young boys and being at this kind of, like, elite, you know, all boys school, it was, you know, and particularly Ethan Hawke's character, who is very young Ethan Hawke, very vulnerable, a guy who can't really express himself, who avoids confrontation. And basically, it's all about the ending, where Robin Williams' character has been fired due to the death of a student that the establishment is blaming on him for his unorthodox teaching style. The character played by Robert Sean Leonard, and it's the big moment where where Ethan Hawke makes a stand.
If the poem score for perfection is plotted on the horizontal of a graph...
Mr. Keating, they made everybody sign it.
Mr. Anderson.
You gotta believe me, it's true.
I do believe you, Tom.
Leave, Mr. Keating.
But it wasn't his fault.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson. One more outburst from you or anyone else, and you're out of this school. Leave, Mr. Keating. I said leave, Mr. Keating.
Captain, my captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson. You hear me? Sit down. Sit down. This is your final warning, Anderson. How dare you?
And that always gets me. And every time I've watched it, like, the more I've grown up, I can see, you know, what Simon was talking about before. The manipulation, like, when you watch that film objectively as an adult, some of it doesn't really make sense. Like, the Robert Sean Leonard storyline is a little bit maybe irresponsible, or kind of like, it's you can tell that the movie is laying down the tracks to get to this moment, and it's not really investing it with maybe the kind of the gravity or the realism that you might expect. But yeah, it always works on me. So even though I know completely, like objectively in the back of my mind, this is manipulation. This like that kind of like that Irish music. I know it's all a con, but I still can't help it. I still can't help crying. And obviously now it gains a lot more subtext to it because of the passing of Robin Williams as well. So now you're watching it with this other element of just kind of sadness to it. But Taylor, what about you and your relationship to this film and moment?
Well, Tristan, I want to ask, how old were you when you first watched it?
Probably like, I feel like it would be, because it was one of those movies that I think my parents taped from TV, and it was like, it's PG. Like, you can, like, there's nothing. I mean, that's the thing. It's got suicide in it, but it was pretty much understood as a kind of film that, you know, a family could watch. And so I think it probably would be like, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I was 17 when I first saw this film. I was in sort of my final year of high school. And I remember watching it at home on a DVD because it was something that we talked about in what was my like year 12 literature class, and we were kind of in this very intense pre-university course. And so I watched this and was really emotional because I somehow connected with Robin Williams' character because I had my own sort of like Mr. Keating in my own life.
Oh, wow.
I drew that parallel, which was quite weird. But to see sort of how students connected with this teacher and like how much importance and influence he had, I felt like I experienced the same thing, even though I had absolutely no context or no relation to these students in any sort of way.
I think that's really interesting. And I think kind of almost what we're talking about with a pet example, right? Mm. Which is if you've got a pet, the movies where the animal dies is going to kick up a level. But I think this one's a little bit more rare, right? Like, And I'm going to admit something. I've actually never seen Dead Poets Society.
Oh, wow, yeah, yeah.
This is one of those
films. I really
films.
Spoiled it for you then.
Yeah. I didn't know until this point how it ended. But I do wonder how you would react to it if you didn't have that teacher.
Mm.
You know, like if you didn't have that one teacher in particular that was like, oh, that was the guy or that was the woman who really shaped me or made me think of things differently. And it sounds like you had that guy or that teacher.
Totally. I definitely had him. It was also as well... because I didn't go to an all-boys school, obviously. But the idea of seeing sort of young boys or adolescent boys in this sort of really sensitive way, that was really different. And I hadn't really been exposed to that before. So that was also a bit like, oh, this is really different and I don't know how I feel about this. And, oh, here come the tears.
Yeah. But, yeah, directed by Australia's own Peter Weir, and I think it was 1989. And, it was a big hit at the time and one of those films as well that for Robin Williams, who was known more for being a comedy actor, a comedy persona, that set that kind of trend of comedy actors, comedians kind of doing a serious film and showing that they had that kind of range and versatility, even though there's a classic scene where he works at his sort of his trademark shtick and does a John Wayne impression and stuff like that. It's almost like the equivalent of Miss Doubtfire, where he there's a montage where he does a lot of impressions or something like that. But yeah, look, that's amazing that it was more because you had that kind of. You could relate more to the experience of the kind of teacher student relationship. Mm.
You didn't have that teacher, Tristan?
There were teachers. I mean, not to the level of of what's portrayed here, where he is like this kind of dynamic figure who really like and his character and the whole persona has been parodied many a time by different comedies. But yeah, probably not to that level where he is a kind of like this almost like a mythic rebellious figure. But you know, there's always I think for anyone who's had that that teacher who at least kind of like took you a little bit seriously or saw that you had kind of like potential and usually they are, I guess, more in the creative fields, whether it be English or art. I hope that's a common experience, but for those who don't, I guess this is a wish fulfillment fantasy then.
Well, look, we asked the people. Yes. We put the vote. Australia voted. And Angie Boyce said Dead Poets Society was one of the movies it was the number one movie that made her cry, along with Watership Down, the 1978 version. My Girl, of course. Mm. I mean, for our generation, I think that was a That was a touchstone. The rest of that we won't get into. The rest of the list, that's a different different subject matter. but Dead Poets Society. Did anyone else say that one?
So basically, I put out the question to people in terms of what was a movie that made them cry, and Dead Poets Society came up. One that came up a lot, and a very dark movie indeed, but a few people suggested this, but I might read. Dancer in the Dark, the Lars von Trier film with Bjork. A few people have written down. Joey, we're going to shout out to Joey K. I think the most I ever cried during a film was Dancer in the Dark. Just howled, fuck you, von Trier. Language warning there. You can believe that. And then Claire Trollio, shout out to Claire. Dancer in the Dark for me too. I saw it at Somerville and I bawled. Was supposed to go out after and I had to go straight home. So
wow.
The ways that a movie can really affect you.
Taylor,
at night.
This is interesting. Have you seen Dancer in the Dark?
I've not, no.
Okay, so this is a musical.
Okay.
But it's a Lars von Trier musical, so it's part of his Dogma movement. I think it still was part of that, and really, really, reduced to its bare bones, effectively. And Bjork plays a blind woman who ends up on death row, and she's trying to pay for her son's surgery or something. I can't even remember because this is a one and done movie. This is the movie you watch once and you go, I'm probably never watching this again, even though it's beautiful, brilliant. She's really good in it. Mm. And apparently the only reason she hasn't done more acting or any acting since then is because Lars von Trier was so terrible to her on set. But look, she gives this grueling performance and the last 10 minutes is her doing the march of death, effectively. And again, the music's fantastic and her performance is really good in the final, 120 seconds of the film is just devastating. Tristan, how did you react to it? Did you cry in this one?
I mean, it is. I remember a friend, shout out to Jared, loved the movie. And like, I sat down to watch it and we even wrote something for a zine where we just like talked about it because Lars von Trier, I think at the time I had a big problem with some of his films, but over time I kind of got a bit more on the wavelength, particularly after seeing Dogville, which I really liked. But there is a definitely sense in the idea of manipulation that he is like forcing these situations, and it's kind of like an ode to these like silent movie melodramas, but like there's these situations that happen that you think are easily resolvable, but they're just there to make this completely depressing, completely punishing situation happen. And in his films, they usually do happen to women. Someone else mentioned another film that makes him cry a lot is Breaking the Waves with Emily Watson. And he's got a kind of like a series of these films where women just go through the worst possible treatment by life. So yeah, it's definitely one that I don't go back to, but it's quite harrowing as well.
It's definitely not like a double feature with Singing in the Rain or My Fair Lady or anything like that. It's an absolute bummer. I might jump to one of my next examples before we return to the list, because I've gone a bit too modern, I feel. Well, not too modern, but I've gone with a lot of new choices. And I don't know if that's because I look back on those older films or, as someone who, worked as a film critic, maybe I approached a lot of those older ones more academically. And then the ones that I'm seeing fresh for the first time, I guess I'm just more open to in that sense. But one that really made me cry, and I kind of wanted to cite it because it's similar to the guilt trip example of what you said with Roger Ebert saying joy kind of can inspire more tears or more effective tears than sorrow, and that is the ending of the movie Hunt for the Wilder People.
Ah, yes.
Taylor, have you seen Hunt for the Wilder People?
No, I haven't seen this one either.
I won't give it away. It's actually a very subtle moment, and doesn't even constitute a spoiler, effectively. But this is the great Taika Waititi film, who's obviously gone on to direct Thor Ragnarok and had previously made Boy and What We Do in the Shadows. But the film is about Sam Neill and Julian Dennison's characters. They go on the run from the law, and it's a very funny and very warm movie. He's sort of a reluctant father, and he's sort of a troublemaking kid, but eventually they come to love each other and call each other family. And at the end of the movie, Sam Neill's character, he is illiterate throughout the movie, and by the end, he's been in sort of a men's home, and he's learned to write a little bit, and he writes a haiku for the boy and shares it with him. And it's a haiku. It's got, you know, probably, what, 18 words or however many syllables. And it is very simple and rudimentary. And by the end of it, you're just crying. It's just a beautiful tribute. And so, again, really underplayed, even though it's a very vulnerable moment.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, it's great how that movie and similarly with Boy, like a previous film that Taika Waititi made, they're kind of like a full meal of a movie in that they have like the comedy, there's kind of like a adventure and action sometimes, and then like these moments of humanity and yeah, it, like I was very moved by that moment as well. And sometimes it is just like, you know, it's just a simple moment, or we're in a character as the one that Sam Neill plays, who was kind of very like grizzled and embittered and kind of
closed off,
kind of you know, warms up. And it's and as well at the start of the film, that also has a death of a character at the kind of the first kind of 20 minutes. That's quite sad and quite moving as well. So yeah, definitely Hunt for the Wilder People.
Tristan, what is your number two?
Number two.
Oh no, we're not ranking these. Sorry. But what is your next your next choice?
This is I like the idea of thinking about like recent movies that make you cry, and because I think often we think of films that affect us a lot when we're younger and create that kind of emotion. But someone reminded me of we've talked about this film in Movie Squad. I think the other year that I saw it at Revelation Film Festival, and it was definitely one of my favorite films of that year, which was The Rider, directed by Chloe Zhao. But I just remember the feeling of it being a very, it's a slow kind of docudrama about a rodeo rider who has been injured and has been told that he can't ride anymore. If he does, he'll possibly, you know, hurt himself or die. And I just remember the experience of I had no real anticipation or kind of knowledge of what the film was. I just heard that it was like well reviewed, so I bought a ticket, went to see it, and it's a slow movie, a slow burn. It uses like the main character's family. The story is a kind of mirror of what he went through in his own life, being a kind of a Native American rodeo rider cowboy, and their family who lives in this trailer park. His sister, I can't remember what she has as well, but you know, he cares for her and looks after her. Their dad is it's a bit of a ne'er do well, a bit of a drunk in the film. But yeah, this moment where all throughout the first hour of the film he's been kind of like told, you shouldn't be riding, you have to do other things. And then the moment he gets on the horse and rides, and the camera like really does it in a kind of long take and pulls back, and I just was I was just crying like anything in the cinema. I was just like, it just like, it was such a slow burn, but it like, when that happened, it just all fell out. It was just like a floodgate opening. Yeah.
The Rider's a really beautiful movie. How do you feel that Chloe Zhao, the director, is now moving on to the Marvelverse? She's helming, I think, The Eternals, it's called, which is the next big, I guess, franchise within the Marvel. Like, does this, when you were watching this sensitive movie about a rodeo rider getting back on the horse, did it make you think, yeah, send her into outer space?
Well, I mean, I'm glad that she, like, it's, you know, for any like director who, because, you know, she's extensively been an independent director who's worked. I haven't seen her previous film, but she's worked in kind of this area of this like reservation and building stories up from real people there. So it is quite a turn to see her like working in this like bigger budget mode. You know, I hope all the best, and that she brings that kind of, I'm sure, like that poetic quality to this film. But hopefully, I'm anticipating the best. Yeah.
Taylor, before we get to your next choice, I have a question for you, because a lot of people chimed in with a certain branch of examples, and they do fall under, you know, if we're talking about Marvel, they fall under the Disney umbrella, which is the Pixar sort of brand, right?
Sure.
The idea being that Pixar films are almost like they've got the formula worked out to make you really cry. And I always found funny that Coco, the movie from a couple of years ago, was a beautiful movie and very organic, but I found it funny that that's a movie about dead characters, you know, almost about ghosts, but even the ghosts can die again in the world of Coco. Like, even some ghosts have
There's
another
no
death.
End.
There's no end to the ways in which Pixar films kind of manipulate you into crying, effectively as it may be. Have you succumbed to that? Are you someone who, when you go to a Pixar film, you know you're down to cry?
Yeah, because, and Roland actually touched on this when he commented on Facebook, Toy Story 3, which came out, I think it was quite significant after, like, it was a period of time had passed,
about
right?
10 years, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so I remember going and seeing Toy Story 3, which is a Pixar film,
yes.
I believe, and just bawling my eyes out, because this was something that I grew up with. This was a legacy. It was very important to me. Woody and Buzz were huge. They were everything. And then being older, it was like this parting ways kind of thing, and they were also parting ways, and there's the scene of them, like, in the... Is it a fire or something?
There's two key moments, right? The first one is when they're all in the incinerator.
That's it.
And they all hold hands and embrace death. And that's the closest I've ever been in a cinema that was like primal scream therapy, where the entire audience was, and I'm not lying, wailing. And then there's the final moment, which is when Andy says goodbye to all the toys, which was the one that hit it for you.
Oh my gosh, it was both. It was the incinerator initially, though.
Yeah.
That was like, what do you mean it can't end? I'm not ready to let go. I think I was also like very much in my late teens at this point, so like I was ready to let go.
Sure.
I had let go.
You were like Andy. Yeah.
Yeah, I was, but Pixar were like, hang on. You're not ready to let go. Have one more good cry in the cinema.
Yeah.
I don't know. Bring a kid next time.
And now Toy Story 4. when is coming?
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know if I can do it to myself.
I don't know. Can they we haven't seen Toy Story 4 as of this recording. Can they go for the big sobby ending again? Can they play that card, Tristan?
I haven't seen Toy Story 3, and
what?
I'm a bit scared to watch it with all the talk about the incinerator. But yeah, I think Pixar usually try to, you know, they want to create an emotional impact. So even the most commercial of their enterprises are still like laced with some kind of sentimentality or emotional pull. So I don't know if they'll go as dark, but I'm sure they'll always kind of reach for that. But I mean, what other film did you have down for this topic?
So I noticed when I was writing this list, when you asked me to be a guest on this episode, films that I cried at or films that I can remember crying as I watched are all things that I watched when I was sort of in my like 14 to 17 period. And they're also films that are maybe a little bit older than that. So there's nothing really recent. The most recent is the one that I'm about to talk about, which was 2009, and I only watched this film after reading the book. I'm talking about The Lovely Bones, which was a novel.
Yeah.
It came out in the early 2000s from Alice Sebold. Folks, I'm sure, are familiar. You've both seen
I've not actually seen it,
film?
But yeah.
Okay.
I've seen it and read the book, yeah.
Okay, so I read the book. I think I was, 14, right as the film came out. I thought, I'm going to read the book first. And I did, and it was a bit like, oh my God, what the hell? and then I watched the film, and I felt like it stuck pretty close as you can, because there's a lot of sort of up here ethereal thing going on.
It's a close adaptation. I don't think it's a... I think it's a good adaptation, but I think it's a bad movie because I think it lived better in the book, if that makes sense.
I agree.
It's one of those films that... one of those stories that I think... You almost need to just imagine it, and I don't think they were able to realise it quite as well on the screen.
Right, and I felt the same way, and I read the book, and I thought it was a fantastic and very terrifying story, being sort of around the age of the characters. But then I watched the film, and I guess at that age I wasn't really able to differentiate between both. So I watched the film, and it gave me like this visual component of it. And I just cried because it was so terrifying. I think this is one of the only films where I've cried because of how scary it was. I don't think I've ever cried. Yeah, I don't think I've ever cried at a film that's like scared me.
Wow.
But this one was terrifying.
I think, like the experience of being a 14-year-old girl, first of all, and then being that exact age when you watch the movie would be very, really challenging. I mean, for those who don't know, this is the first, 20 minutes of the film. Saoirse Ronan's character is a young girl who is, murdered and brutalized in a horrifying fashion by her neighbor, I think, played by Stanley Tucci. And then the rest of the film kind of takes place in the afterlife as she's watching her family try and solve her murder or get on with their own lives. Mm. And in the book, I found that just it was a really, I think people criticized it in a sense that it's, spiritual hokum, sort of a bit close to the secret. I reject that. I think it's actually quite a nice way to think about, you know, moving on after a horrendous tragedy. The film, like I said, didn't work for me, but yeah, being 14, being a woman, the experience of watching that must have been just really jarring.
It was, and I guess as well, a lot of the concepts were really complex and things that I hadn't been exposed to before. So that was terrifying and that was really sad. But there was sort of a moment of, I guess, not happy crying, but I don't know, relief crying in watching the family and reading about the family sort of in their closeness trying to find closure and like, because it was... Yeah, I don't know how to describe that.
That stuff is way better than the murder mystery element, I think. You know, that doesn't really play. But the family, you know, it sounds bad, but getting over it or moving on. And in the book as well, I can't remember if the movie does it, the book jumps quite a few years in the future, whereas the Saoirse Ronan character or the girl is sort of trapped in her state, in her preteen sort of age. But it makes me think of Keanu Reeves' most recent interview on Stephen Colbert, where Stephen Colbert asked him what happens when we die, and Keanu very sincerely and beautifully just says, "I think the people we leave behind will miss us a lot." Aww. And that is basically the premise of the Lovely Bones.
I guess it's like when you are young and you watch things like Paulie or Toy Story, and it sets you up to understand that like ending happens and death happens and how to sort of deal. This kind of goes one step further as you kind of get a little bit older as well.
Yeah. I think films about the afterlife have always been a bit tricky. I think there's the Robin Williams movie, What Dreams May Come.
Yeah.
A few other examples that I can't think of immediately. I don't know if we've had the perfect afterlife movie yet. The Good Place is doing a good job of it, but that's not really a solemn show. Tristan, are there any films that maybe you had narrowed down about death or about what happens next that kind of struck a chord with you? Or are you like me where you try not to think about that stuff?
Well, I mean, look, I'll give a shout out to, I haven't watched this film in a while, but I remember, you know, it made my, you know, it was one of my mother's favorites. And I always loved this period of time when I was younger where like my parents would tape stuff of TV and I wouldn't really care. Like I had no kind of like concept of like genre or gendered expectations where I was just like, oh, I'll watch it, like Pretty Woman, I'll just watch that, or Green Card, I'll watch that, I don't care, like I'll watch anything. But like Ghost and just like the final moment of where Patrick Swayze kind of goes to the good place, to heaven, with Maurice Jarre's score, which is kind of doing a sort of very orchestrated version of the big song from the film, which is
Unchained Melody.
Yeah, Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. And that had a big impact. I remember crying a lot. And now, and unfortunately now it has this other element as well with Swayze's passing too. But yeah.
Do you still cry in Roadhouse when he rips the guy's throat out?
When look, no spoilers, but there's a character who doesn't make it to the last reel, and
I'm glad we're not spoiling Roadhouse, but we've spoiled like 9 other films.
Well, priorities.
Anyway, does that usually happen in podcasts? It's like, is film spoiled, or is it just because I've
I think there's a look. We're not, people can turn off when they want, and we're not afraid necessarily of like radio. You don't want people to turn off at any point, so we try and steer away. But people, look, you got the 30-second skip function.
Sure.
And we're not talking about anything immediately recent, so I hope that everyone will forgive us for this particular episode.
Yeah, and look, I was like on the podcast Switchblade Sisters with April Wolf, LA film critic. She always likes to say, look, it's not what happens in the film, it's how it happens. So even if you know like what happens in a movie, sometimes it can't prepare you for the impact it can have.
Sure.
Exactly. I did want to, my kind of last example that came to mind, and I did purposely kind of go back to try and find a classic film that had affected me. And it is about death, so I apologize that we've arrived at this really grim place for the conclusion of the podcast. But it's the Akira Kurosawa film Ikiru.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, have either of you seen it?
I've heard a lot about it. Sure, I've always wanted to see it. But
it's not one of his top, in terms of regard, not one of his top tier films like Seven Samurai or Yojimbo or even Throne of Blood. But it's a really interesting, sometimes comedic film about a bureaucrat who's died. And this was a guy who lived his life, didn't really care for the people around him and for his family. And much of the movie is about these other bureaucrats kind of just squabbling at his funeral, you know? And what we come to realize at the funeral, as it sort of flashes back, is that he found out he was dying and he kind of tried to decide what life he wanted to live in his final days. And he becomes sort of obsessed with the very small task of just building a playground, right? And having to get through the bureaucratic red tape of this tiny, tiny, like, park project, effectively. And then at the end of the film, you realize that the park was built, and you just see the character, this older man, just sitting on a swing in the snow by himself, swinging back and forth, and he's singing, and it's basically an old Japanese sort of folk song, and Ikiru means to live. You know, death comes for us all. We all expire at some point. And what life are you going to live? And how are you going to spend it? And that there is value in those kind of small contributions, you know? Like, your legacy can be small. It can be about your family. It can be about your work. Or it can be a park. And I just think that moment is so beautiful. And I encourage people to just actually, you can, because I know, because I look it up frequently, look up just the Ikiru scene, basically, from Ikiru. Mm. And it's just a beautifully framed and composed moment. It helps to have the whole movie built to it. But if you just want something to compel you to watch the full thing, that's a really beautiful moment.
I guess as well, that's sort of that idea of sort of like, it restores your faith a little bit. Like, not everything is so bad.
It is, yeah. It's a movie about a bureaucrat who learns, whose heart grows three sizes, right? But all that leads to is him building a park. And it's almost an ironic commentary and not as like over the top as, you know, It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Carol and those other similar examples. Mm. But yeah, like you said, it's just this moment of like, okay, things are bad, but they're not all bad, right?
I guess that serves as some sort of point of realistic as well, though.
Exactly. And I think it almost helps to be placed in a, not a nihilistic viewpoint, but to be set in the real world. I mean, this movie's 70 years old now, but to be set in a world that looks like ours and maybe isn't all sunshine and roses, but it really can be about individual contributions. It doesn't have to be about the entire state of the world. It's like, well, what mark are you going to leave? And what are you going to do to make the world better, or to live a good life.
Yeah.
How inspirational.
Yeah, that's...
it's all Kurosawa. Words, yeah. It's all him.
Well, yeah, that's one that I've always wanted to see, so another, you know, fantastic one to put on the to-do list, Akira Kurosawa's Akira. Were there any others that you wanted to mention, Taylor, or should we get stuck into some of the suggestions that people...
Let's get into what other folks have suggested. I like here... Drew has messaged and says that Spirit Away, goddamn, that was a big one for him. He says it feels like it taps into what it is like going through trauma, feeling loss and hopelessness, but then also finding the courage to grow and learn, whether you're a child or later in life.
That's a great example and a great like genre of crying movie, which is like you're not a kid anymore.
Totally.
Like the exact moment you're not a kid. And Eighth Grade was a very recent movie that was very effective in that matter. But Spirited Away is literally, you know, she goes on this fantastical journey, and at the end she's like, okay, that time of my life is done now. And yeah. that's a hard pill to swallow. My neighbor Totoro does the exact same thing, in fact. Tristan, what have you got?
Well, I want to send a shout out to Dev Moore, who wept uncontrollably at Where the Wild Things Are in the cinema and haven't been able to rewatch it to see if it's actually any good since. And that that is similar to me. When I saw the film, I was so, like, there's a moment, and people would, if they've seen it, would know what it is. I was just like lost it and I cried. And I bought this film on DVD and I never watched it since. Like I was just like, I can't go back there. And yeah, it's just such a strange film that was kind of like, you know, it's supposed to be an adaptation of a beloved childhood classic. It seems like only for very miserable adults. But and I also want to mention Aaron McCann. He says, Warrior, the ending always makes me cry. Also Paddington, both films are magical. And Warrior makes me think of also like, yeah, like the Rocky movies and Creed and Creed 2. I was crying during Creed 2. So, yeah, anyway.
I want to give a shout out to Libby Noble, former guest of the podcast. Yeah. She said, "Everything by Ang Lee." And that's, look, I can get on board with that, of course. but she says, "He is the king of pent-up emotions being released. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sense and Sensibility, Brokeback Mountain." And I thought the fourth example was going to be maybe The Ice Storm or Life of Pi, but she's gone with Hulk.
Can I go in on a secret?
Yes.
Libby and I share the same love for Mark Ruffalo
and
the Hulk, so I understand 125% where she comes from when she says that.
But I have to step in here, and Tristan, I know you were about to. This is not the Mark Ruffalo Hulk.
I know.
This is the Eric Banner Hulk.
We know. So,
oh, you know it. Just, okay, well, look.
Still, maybe it's just the Hulk.
So like, maybe it's more Hulk than Ruffalo,
sure.
Because we all like Mark Ruffalo. But yeah, look, good on her, absolutely. And then one that surprised me, if I can find... Find it. Oh, not surprised, but here we go. Sarah Tout, she can't get through a viewing of About Time without bawling at the end. Domhnall Gleeson rhapsodizes about the small moments of connection to be noticed and relished in life every day, and it kills me, or it kills her, she says.
Yeah, look, and a lot of people have also, you know, speaking of childhood trauma, a few people, shout out to Mac, shout out to Matt Patrick, the never-ending story, Artax's death. I haven't watched that film in a long time, but that moment is, burnt on my brain, and, quite traumatic. I'm going to send a shout out to my sister, Sarah. I can't help it, but the park bench scene in Good Will Hunting gets me every time. And a few others to mention as well. Who else do I want to kind of... Lindsay Hallam, The Elephant Man. That came up a few times. Makes me cry buckets every time I watch it. And shout out to Liam as well. Edward Scissorhands always gets me bubbling. That's a big one as well. And another classic movie which I've never seen. Shout out to Robert Forrest. The Best Years of Our Lives is the best movie to make you cry. That's a film from like 1940. So testament to the power of movies. Yeah,
I think we all and there's so many more actually that we can't even get through. But head to the Movie Squad Facebook page and share your thoughts and have a bit of a cry with us. I don't know, like Taylor, after this conversation, are you kind of like, oh, crying movies are good, I want to go watch one that will make me cry? Or are you like, I need to watch like an episode of Killing Eve or something to like...
Yeah, no, I feel like I've had sort of like good group therapy here. I am going to the movies after this. I don't think I'm going to cry for...
What are you saying?
The Hustle. I'm taking my mom.
Ah, yeah.
You might.
Yeah, and I don't think it's for the right reasons.
Yes.
But yeah, look, that's happening. So maybe there'll be some crying. No, it feels good. It's always nice to sort of have films where you do cry. And we talked about this at the beginning because it is that super cathartic thing. And it's like, oh, yes, everyone else is sort of feeling this. And it makes you feel, I don't know, like a little bit more human maybe.
And to be in a cinema where you can hear the tissues coming out and you can hear the sniffling. That gets quite like, you know, in Avengers Endgame, I didn't cry during that and we won't get into it. But it was nice to be with 500 other people who were sniffling and you're like, wow, that's so vulnerable to be like in a public place and just like cry.
I've never cried at in a cinema. I've only ever cried at films like in the comfort and confinements of my own home.
Like you feel like you like have a needed to cry or you try and not cry?
Actually, no, that's a lie. Toy Story 3, there was a few tears. But yeah, no, I don't think I've ever needed to / I've just been very aware that I'm in a very public place.
We should make a point. We should like look down the calendar of what's coming out this year and go, that looks like a tearjerker. Let's go together. We'll, like in Toy Story 3, we'll hold hands throughout the final sequence and just embrace the finality of it all.
Well, we're about to wrap up, but I thought we could spend just a quick, like in terms of actual movie crying, is there any particular actors that you are fans of? Because to me, I always think of like, because we were talking about this beforehand, when someone told me once that when you see an actor cry and the tears come down the middle, that is usually on account of some kind of...
Eye drops.
Yeah, eye drop or gel that they've given to produce that. So that's usually like a sign of a fake cry. But when someone goes full 110% like ugly crying face... And I got to think of like Harvey Keitel and Bad Lieutenant and Reservoir Dogs, just going for it. I like
best
like,
crying while masturbating as well.
There's a separate subcategory there as well. But Harvey Keitel.
There's another thing to watch out for though in this day and age. And I think the first one that was at least publicized was Jennifer Connelly in Blood Diamond, where they CGI'd tears.
Oh, really? Wow.
So you need to be careful now. You got to watch for the tears. do they leave tracks in other scenes or in other, when they cut back to them, do they still have the kind of wet face? You know, the wet face of a crying
wild
person. So you got to be careful. You got to be able to know whether they've actually cried.
Oh my gosh. I didn't put anyone down for best crying. I did definitely put two people down for worst crying.
Oh, yes. So, we'd like to hear that.
So the first one, which I'm kind of, I don't know, I feel like people are going to be angry about this, is Daniel Radcliffe in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
That's fair.
The scene where Cedric Diggory dies, it's awkward, it's weird, people are like pushing him, and it just, it's very sort of hand-fisted the whole way that scene plays out, I think.
Sure.
The other one is is an old film. It's the Franco Zeffirelli make of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
I thought Olivia Hussey just moaned, and it was so awkward.
She's Juliet in the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And she's just like moaning and like can't get herself out of bed, and it's like, oh, for God's sake, woman, pull it together.
See, I'd offer that, you know, at least with Baz Luhrmann's version, Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes were like sensational on-screen cries, particularly Claire Danes just does
Claire
the most with her face. Yeah.
That's a cottage industry for Claire Danes. Yeah. Like Homeland, she won like however many Emmys or whatever, but she basically just has that cry face throughout the whole show.
She's a beautiful crier.
Yeah, I love a good ugly cry, and that's why the one I actually immediately thought of was Tom Hanks at the end of Captain Phillips when he's in shock. He does come to cry in that scene, but that whole moment is so like the trauma. It's like it was just a type of crying scene that I hadn't seen before, and how they played that was so organic. I do want to say I've got a few ugly criers. Tom Cruise in Magnolia.
Oh, classic.
Philip Seymour Hoffman in Boogie Nights. Mm. Will Ferrell in Anchorman. but I did want to say that I do love one particular... and Tony Collette in Hereditary. That was actually... A few people wrote in about that. Mm. Denzel Washington's Single Tear in Glory. That's got to be the title holder. The most iconic cry in history and most imitated, surely.
Yes. The glory tear, yeah. Well, those are fantastic suggestions I think that's a great subcategory in terms of because some actors can really go over the top. I think of Sean Penn in Mystic River. Is that my daughter?
No,
in
that's
there? Not. That's, and then when it's a bit more, I think often like I find them even more emotional when someone is trying not to cry, and that really, I can't think of an example, but that always hits me. But I think this has been a very cathartic episode. Thank you to everyone who offered suggestions, and thank you especially to you, Taylor, for coming in the weekend clothes and being a guest on this extended I second Simon's. These are very good weekend clothes in comparison to what I'm wearing, but thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people hear more of you?
Every weekday between 6 and 9 on RTRFM 92.1.
Do you want people to send in their favourite crying movies? Is that something?
Please do, yeah. we'll read them out next Friday or something. It'll be great.
Perfect.
Well, there you go. Another sensational episode of the Movie Squad podcast. Whoa.
We're starting again.
Oh, no. Watch out. There you go. Now that's going to make me cry. Anyway, so thank you so much for listening. And we hope that you have a great time at the movies, crying or otherwise.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.